All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Joseph L. Toth presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near and you will be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable.
Good afternoon. I'm Judge Toth. I'm joined by Judge Lauer to my right and Judge Jaquith to my left. We are convened today to consider arguments in the matter of Mary Nelson versus Douglas A. Collins, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 24-3503. The court would like to also acknowledge and welcome attorneys from the Department of Veterans Affairs who are with us today, so welcome. Will counsel, beginning with appellant's counsel, please enter your appearance for the record.
Renee Burbank for Mary Nelson.
Good afternoon.
For the secretary, Brian Carey, and with me today is Mark Vichich.
Yes. Thank you. And would appellant's counsel like to reserve time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. We'd like to reserve 10 minutes.
Okay, so noted. One quick housekeeping thing. If we're asking you questions, don't worry about time. Take as much time as you need as long as you're responsive to our questions. Once we stop, if you need a minute, you can ask for a minute. Otherwise, we'll try to stick to the time allotted. If counsel are ready, we'll begin with appellant's counsel, Ms. Burbank. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Near the end of his life, veteran Gary Nelson could not live independently. His wife, Mary, provided him with the care and help that he needed to live in his home with as much dignity as possible. She helped him bathe and dressed him. She helped him into bed and into the car. She stayed with him to make sure he didn't fall, and she helped with his extensive medications and other medical needs due to diabetes, hepatitis C, and liver cancer that had metastasized to his bones. The Family Caregiver Program exists to support people like the Nelsons, but they were denied entry, and the board wouldn't even hear the merits of Mrs. Nelson's appeal. Now, by today, I think our case has been narrowed down to just two issues, two prejudicial errors that this court must remand the case to remedy. The first is that VA has not made an assessment, which is required by statute, as to whether Mrs. Nelson required training, instruction, or other preparation to be able to provide personal care services to Mr. Nelson. And the second is whether VA can require a home visit as a condition of eligibility and admission, which again is contrary to statute. So first, starting with...
So just to slow you down. So What is the state? I mean, I looked at the evidentiary record, but I mean, how would you describe it in terms of its completion? I mean, they did the eligibility assessment and became an adverse determination. Then what else did they do?
That's it.
That's all.
They stopped the process. The way the caregiver program works is that it's a step-by-step process. There's an initial screening, sort of, are you a veteran? Do you meet the 70% threshold? And then they'll do a veteran assessment, and then the functional assessment instrument. And that's the process that's in the record. That happened, and then they made an eligibility determination.
Right, it was 2020, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was done telephonically?
That's right. The eligibility determination at that stage typically is done telephonically.
So that's still the norm?
That's right.
Telephonic, okay.
Right. It can be in person, but it is not required to be in person.
So if it's telephonic, obviously the any in-home assessment would have to be done separately.
If VA decides to do an in-home assessment as part of its intake process, which is not required by statute, and in fact, if you want to start with the home visit, I'm happy to do that. The home visit is contemplated by the statute in only one place. That's in A9, which is part of the ongoing monitoring of veterans and caregivers who are already admitted into the program. And there, A9C says that the secretary can establish or shall establish follow-up procedures and Such procedures may include visiting an eligible veteran in the eligible veteran's home. That is the only place where the statute contemplates a home visit. It's not part of the eligibility criteria. It's not part of the assessment. The assessment that VA does is wholly a creation of its regulation, and it's decided, the secretary has decided to use home visits, but the actual determination that it has to make at that stage isn't a checkbox of did you do a home visit. It's, is this in the best interest of the veteran? Is the caregiver competent? Those can be done with other pieces of evidence that are in the record, and that's what VA should do now. It can go back and look at what the record has, and there is ample evidence in this record that VA will have to contend with about how Mary Nelson was already providing care for her husband in his home at the time.
So I'm glad you began with the statute, because, I mean, obviously this is a big case with a big question, and normally, you know, what we would do to answer it is just look at the statute and figure out, I mean, did Congress intend for these types of benefits to be payable after the death of a joint claimant? And I mean, obviously, you know, the statute's complicated, but you take a look at it, and most of it is clearly sort of forward looking, right? And so there's eligibility assessments. There's a lot of other stuff that, you know, the Federal Circuit would probably have deemed kind of medical determinations about treatment, care, right? The suitability of the home, various things. What happens? What indication do you get from Congress that this type of inquiry was meant to be kind of retrospective in nature?
Well, there are, of course, several pieces of this that are not necessarily only prospective. It is certainly true that prospectively talking about things like ongoing respite care and counseling, that can only happen prospectively once you're in the program. And Mrs. Nelson does not seek anything in recompense for those benefits. But when we're talking about the stipend itself, this court and the Federal Circuit have talked about that stipend is a benefit for which there is judicial review and board review. And the way that the statute works is obviously thinking about someone who applies and how to assess whether they are eligible. But there's nothing that contemplates there's nothing that explicitly talks about what happens if during the process of making that assessment, the veteran is no longer eligible, whether the veteran passes away or ends up going to a nursing home and is no longer receiving care. But the secretary has conceded in his amended brief that the veteran does not need to continue to be eligible throughout the processing, throughout the entire appeal period, that you can be entitled to retroactive benefits.
Right, but let's say, like, the, you know, the best interest language, right? Because, I mean, you know, it's important. I mean, Congress kind of leads with it as being central to, you know, whether, you know, so they shall only approve when it's in the best interest. What happens to that language when the claimant's deceased? I mean, do they do a retroactive assessment to see if, given the evidence of record, it would have been in the best interest of the veteran to, like, or that this care was in the best interest of the veteran? I mean, how do we work this?
Yes, I think that's exactly right, that there needs to be a review of whether the provision of the care that he needs is, or she needs, is in the veteran's best interest to occur at home from a family caregiver.
Well, like, can they make an independent assessment of whether there was abuse, right? I mean, obviously, prospectively, elder abuse is a serious problem. It's a very high concern for the secretary, I imagine, that the care given will be dignified for the claimant. Does that just fall away when it's done retrospectively, or can they kind of do fact finding on whether the care was of a certain quality?
The record would have, the VA will have to look at the record and see if there is any evidence in the record that can establish that this was in the best interest of the veteran.
What if the evidence?
So here, for example, there is record evidence the process did get far enough that the caregiver team was coordinating with Mr. Nelson's primary care team, and there are notes from the doctors saying this is the condition, you know, this is the care that he needs. Mary is already providing that care and is doing an excellent job. That's the kind of evidence that VA can look to make that best interest determination retrospectively. And indeed, VA has no problem doing that sort of retrospective analysis in the current scheme as long as the veteran is still alive. So the 7140D, the effective date regulation, contemplates giving an effective date all the way back to the application date if the care was being provided in the home and if the family caregiver was in fact providing that care at the time. And that analysis, in a world in which if there's an initial decision that the veteran isn't eligible, they appeal to the board remands, and then there's a decision, that can be years later that VA is finally moving on to this determination of best interest determination and then also admitting someone into the program and giving that retroactive period. They're looking back at that entire period, and VA is capable of doing that. It does that pretty routinely in these cases. The sole exception is it's saying, well, when we are in a world where the veteran has died and through no fault of the veteran or the caregiver, VA has not conducted a home visit and will not conduct a home visit, that falls on the caregiver, that the caregiver is the one who gets hurt by VA's mistakes and not admitting someone when they initially applied. And that's just not contemplated by the statute. The statute doesn't say, well, if you only get benefits, the stipend benefits prospectively, and this whole scheme of providing meaningful appellate review requires an ability to go back and say, hey, we're going to give this effective date back to the date that
so they have not done a caregiver eligibility determination in this case.
They've done a partial. So what they have done is they verify that she's over 18, that they've done a little bit of the eligibility requirement, but they have not made the determination of competence that's required under A6, or I think that's right. Sorry, excuse me, A7. That specific finding of fact has not been made because, again, VA has decided to sort of cut off its whole analysis at that veteran eligibility point, and because it hasn't done the rest of the analysis, it's very convenient for VA to say, well, if we stop processing your application, the fact that we haven't processed your application is why you lose. And that's effective. That's what's happening here.
But I mean, the statute seems to offer some type of delegation to the secretary to kind of craft, you know, obviously they can do a form of application, and presumably they can sort of craft different ways of evaluating the kind of necessary eligibility requirements. Have you challenged any? I mean, are you challenging any of the regulations specifically, or any of the
Mrs. Nelson is not asking this court, and she herself does not want to sort of dictate exactly how VA administers this program. She is not saying that VA is not permitted to ever conduct home visits as part of its initial eligibility assessment. The question is simply one of what happens when VA fails to do that, when VA decides not to do a home visit. Does that preclude a caregiver from being eligible for retroactive benefits, or is the VA's own failure and it just has to look at, the agency just has to look at the rest of the body of record evidence to make its determinations? Because what's required by statute is not a home visit, but again, these assessments of competence, that it's in the best interest of the veteran, and that can be done on the record. The VA can do that and look to whether a caregiver was competent by looking to see whether they were actually already providing care, whether that care was effective, whether the veteran's primary care team was including and believed that the caregiver was doing a good job. And all of that is here in this record. And it's something that the VA, the board, has never contended with, and neither has the AOJ, and that's what that needs to be done on remand.
Was there also contact between VA and Mrs. Nelson between the assessment calls in December of 2000 and the call saying you're ineligible, followed by the letter on January 13th and 14th of 2001?
By the caregiver team, I don't believe so. There may have been, and I can do it when I sit down to see if there's anything in the record of proceedings that's before this court that talks about communications with the rest of Mr. Nelson's. You know, the VA was providing care to Mr. Nelson prior to his death, in between that October application and his death in March. She was having communications with the VA generally, but not with the caregiver team. I'm not sure if that answers Your Honor's question.
It does.
Okay.
So in the appellant's opinion, there is enough record evidence for the board to get to the merits and make fact-finding regarding both the eligibility of the veteran in this case as well as the caregiver.
Or the board would have to remand if it determines that there needs to be an initial factual finding by the AOJ on, say, for example, the best interest determination. That's not before this court, whether the best interest determination requires any sort of medical determination that the board can't make in the first instance. And at this point, I don't have a position on whether things would have to go back to the caregiver support program as well. But yes, that kind of determination needs to be done by the agency on some level.
Okay. And as you noted, the secretary has conceded that the board erred by finding as a matter of law that Mr. Nelson was ineligible. And that was the December 2020 determination that was made. And so the board never got to the merits of looking at the record, reviewing it to see if, in fact, the record provided enough evidence to make a determination as to eligibility both for Mr. Nelson and Mrs. Nelson as the caregiver.
That's right. That's right, Your Honor. That the board never made a determination that Mrs. Nelson was asking the board to make, which was Mr. Nelson in fact eligible for this program? And then if so, do the rest of the process that VA hadn't done to determine whether she was eligible? And if so, at what level of stipend? That's another issue that would have to be determined. And again, I'm not sure that the board would make that in the first instance. It would likely remand for that kind of determination of what level of stipend would be Mrs. Nelson would have been eligible for if she had been admitted in the first instance.
And for the caregiver, it sounds like you would acknowledge that there could be situations where, because the education and training did not occur prior to the death of the veteran here, that there could be situations where there would be a lack of eligibility based simply on the fact that that was not completed.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And then that takes me to the training part of the statute, which I wanted to speak to before I run out of time. The statute at A5 requires an assessment, and this is at A5B, of the family member, right? For any application submitted, the secretary shall evaluate in collaboration with a primary care team, if possible, not only what this particular veteran needs in terms of personal care services, but also whether the family member requires any training, and if so, what training. I'm using training to encompass both instruction, preparation, and training. And VA has not done that here.
You're referring to the if any?
The if any.
Family member right. Determine amount of instruction, preparation, and training, if any.
That's right. And this is because the statute encompasses two possible scenarios, right? One where there is a caregiver who is already providing competent care, who does not need any additional training to provide the care that the veteran needs. And then the answer to this, if any, is none. None is required. But there's also a scenario where a caregiver, a family member wants to be a caregiver, but cannot yet provide that competent care, right? Requires, I need to learn how to do a safe toilet transfer. I need to learn how to do this diabetes medication management in order to provide the care at home for this veteran, right? The veteran might be in the hospital and not able to go home yet because there's not someone who can safely take care of the veteran yet. And that kind of training is that kind of determination of what this veteran and this caregiver needs is what's required. And yes, on remand, there might be a scenario where the records suggest actually this caregiver did require training, didn't receive it, and therefore would not be entitled to retroactive benefits. That's whether or not the veteran has passed away. And that's all encompassed within the effective date regulation as well. It mirrors that sort of understanding that sometimes the caregiver has already provided the care for the entire period of the processing of the application, in which case you can have an effective date as of the application. Or if that care doesn't start until after training occurs, then the effective date is when the care starts being provided. That is reflecting the structure created by the statute, and that's what is missing in this sort of rote checkbox, did you do the training that we give, that we require of absolutely everyone. There's a step zero, a do you need training at all, that the secretary has not done.
I realize that the appellant is not challenging the secretary's regulations, but do you note any inconsistencies in the language, for example, with respect to the if any regarding training and the implementing regulations?
Yes, Your Honor. And to be clear, Mrs. Nelson says to the extent the regulations are inconsistent with the framework created by the statute, they need to be either set aside or read in an as-applied challenge, that actually in the circumstance that we're faced with in this case, the language of the regulation, to the extent that regulations are sort of you must complete this training in order to be admitted into the program, that's inconsistent with the statute.
I have a line of questioning I want to explore. You know, Baudet, I guess all the litigation about 1720G up until this point has really focused on this idea, what the language of medical determinations means, right? And so before us, I mean, we ruled that whatever it meant, it wasn't a jurisdiction-stripping provision that brought the statute outside of the VGRA. Mm-hmm. The Federal Circuit, I think, took a narrower approach than we did, and they really differentiated between sort of classic eligibility determinations, which are, you know, sort of legal in nature, and then I think procedural things, you know, if it noted, and medical determinations. And it stated pretty unequivocally that the 20.104 language, the regulatory language, you know, about medical determinations being beyond the board's jurisdiction, that remains valid. So as I see it, I mean, you look at the statute, you look at the regulations, you look at just the amount of things that kind of go into this eligibility determination and the whole roundup. Lots of it's medical in nature, right? It would seem to be, you know, there's recommended maybe treatment A versus treatment B, or, you know, it's very particularized to a defendant. How would, by what principle would you kind of parse out the difference? You know, the board obviously is going to have to, it's going to exercise jurisdiction over some of this. The, you know, the eligibility determination would seem to fit squarely within it. The ultimate determination of whether you fit the program or not would seem to fit squarely within it. But maybe the course of treatment or something that wouldn't. So what's the principle by which you would resolve that?
Well, here the line is pretty easy to delineate, which is you have to make the determination, right? VA hasn't made, whether the determination of best interest is a medical determination or not, it still has to make that determination. Sure. So that is, I think,
but like,
the only thing this court has to
reach. Stipend, right? Just, I mean, just kind of example to flesh it out, right? So ultimately, like, that's a finding, right? But I think the way that they assess the stipend is based on the course of treatment, obviously the intensity of the treatments, but, you know, factors that are very particular to the veteran. And so you have something like a legal ruling that's going to have to take into account medical considerations, but it's not going to, which in and of themselves are not reviewable, but they might be reviewable as part of the ultimate determination, right?
Right. And there the board would be able to use the types of review that it can do. Like, did you consider the whole record? Did you consider evidence that was in the veteran and caregiver applicant's favor? And if the VA doesn't contend with that at all, it needs to. But as to an actual sort of medical decision about the precise, perhaps like the personal care services that this veteran needs, for example, does this veteran need diabetes medication management? That is a medical determination and not something that the board reviews. But that's not the sort of thing that we're talking about here. We're talking about the eligibility to get in the door. The secretary says, these two things, completing this training program and the home visit, are check boxes. And if we have not let you check the box, then you don't get in the program. And that's the only thing that's before this court today. And I think it's important to recognize that the regulations that we're talking about, the sort of scheme that the framework, rather, that VA has created for how it processes these are regulations that were promulgated in 2020 prior to Beaudet. These were written and drafted with an understanding and an expectation that caregiver decisions operated in that splendid isolation. There was no board review. So whatever VHA says goes. And to the extent there's any inconsistency with these regulations sort of saying, hey, you need to do this and you need to do this, and if we haven't let you do this, you don't get in, that's a problem with the regulation and how the regulations have to comport with Beaudet, not the other way around.
Do you know whether VA was conducting in-person in-home visits during this time frame, during the fall of 2020, during the pandemic?
It was not. It relaxed its standards for an in-home, in-person home visit. The home visits were done, I believe, by video if the veteran and caregiver had that capacity in their home, but otherwise these were done remotely.
What specific relief is the appellant looking for here?
Mrs. Nelson asks that the court reverse the dismissal and remand for a decision on the merits of her appeal, which includes a determination whether she required any training, whether Mr. Nelson was in fact an eligible veteran, and any other determinations that need to be made for admission into the program. The best interest determination is separate from eligibility, for example.
So obviously, once eligibility is determined by the agency, there is a whole list of benefits. Within that list of benefits, some of them, since unfortunately the veteran is deceased here, would no longer really be relevant. So what specifically is Mrs. Nelson looking for in that list of benefits?
At the very, the very end of the downstream benefit, what we're talking about is the stipend. Basically 5 months of retroactive stipend.
From the date of application to the veteran's
passing, yes.
Thank you.
Right, and again, 7040D clarifies that certain of the benefits are only prospective, and Mary Nelson is not challenging the prospective nature of, for example, respite care and continued training and counseling and things like that.
Just a final question. I mean, so there's medical determinations, and then there. So if you look at the statute, I mean, way at the end, Section C has got the section that describes construction. So we dealt with, number one, the medical determination. But Section 2 says nothing in this section shall be construed to create. It says any entitlement to any assistant or support provided under this section. And now there's a lot of different ways to read that. There's a lot in that. One way to read it is to suggest that the statute ultimately gives the secretary some measure of discretion in beyond assessing eligibility is in making an ultimate ruling as to maybe whether it's in the best interest, meaning it's not a statutory property right that when you assert certain facts, you automatically, you know, get a legal property interest under a statute. There still appears to be a kind of measure of discretion on the secretary's part. What do you make of that language? And are there aspects of the decision that are discretionary in nature? How should the board review those?
Looking at C2B, and I think it's important to also look at 2CA, yes. Right? This is about, you know, trying to make sure that they were not creating, this is not an employment relationship. The VA is not employing these caregivers. And there is, as you say, not necessarily, I do not know whether this means there's no property right. We have not analyzed that on Mrs. Nelson's behalf. But I think the fundamental thing that this is trying to do is to say that that this is not creating, it is not solely the caregiver's like property, right? Because this is a program created for the benefit of the veteran ultimately. This is about making sure the veteran gets the kind of care that they need. So there's all sorts of pieces in here as well that talks about the veteran can say, actually, I don't want this caregiver after all, and the caregiver can't fight about that.
Tell me if this makes sense to you, which is that the best interest determination, let's assume the veteran's alive, remains the fundamental, you know, orienting decision the secretary has to make. Is participation in this program in the best interest of the veteran? Does that even remain posthumously? So now the veteran's deceased. Does that remain the governing inquiry as though he were alive? Because, you know, if it's a statutory right, it would be, you know, we did certain things, we can prove it, you get a right. Whereas what you're saying is, no, the eligibility survives the death of the claimant because the joint claimant remains eligible. And he or she can receive the benefit as long as you can establish the eligibility of the other claimant, which is a requirement for the benefit. The way that you would assess that eligibility prospectively or retrospectively remains in the best interest of the veteran.
And I agree that there is a piece of this that is somewhat discretionary. For example, if I could imagine a medical determination that actually, this veteran does have the capacity to be independent if they go through certain physical therapy and using a caregiver to provide those needs instead is perhaps actually a detriment to that. That kind of analysis might be a medical determination. It sounds like, to me, a part of a best interest analysis. And that is something that may be unreviewable by the board because it's a medical determination, right? You shouldn't get in this program. Instead, you should have this other care. That is separate from the sort of eligibility requirement. And it also is something that can be done retrospectively still, right? Whether it's in the best interest of the veteran at the time, are we talking about a veteran who was learning how to become more independent, had that physical therapy option, if there's a substance use disorder, maybe the caregiver is not going to be able to assist with that. There does need to be some kind of other support provided. All of that is something that may or may not be reviewable depending on how it looks on the record. But that's very far from what we're talking about here. We're talking about the secretary saying, his hands are tied because he didn't do these steps. And that is, that's not a medical determination. That's an eligibility thing that this court in Beaudet and the Federal Circuit still upheld, that there is a right to appeal to the board and ultimately get that judicial review. This kind of benefit program is creating a benefit that is appealable. It is not, you know, wholly outside judicial review.
Okay, great. We kept you behind time. Judge Lauer, do you have any more questions?
No, thank you.
Judge Jaquith? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel.
Thank you, Judge Toth, and may it please the court. So as Judge Toth, as you had have been noting, Congress very clearly did not create an entitlement here in enacting the caregivers program. Rather, Congress required the Secretary to make the determination of whether it is in the best interest of the veteran to participate in the program in order to receive or to be provided the required level of care, maybe as opposed to in a different program run by the Secretary. Now, consistent with the statute, and I believe as delegated by the statute and with certain amounts of discretion, the Secretary has developed a multi-step process in order to make that determination of the best interest, which includes clinical evaluations of both the veteran and the home environment. Now here, following the required initial clinical evaluation, VA determined that Mr. Nelson was not eligible. Now I want to clarify something here because I think this is a fundamental error in my colleague's argument that the eligibility determination does incorporate the best interest analysis, and that is per the regulation. The Secretary has determined that, and that is how the Secretary approaches the eligibility. So at that stage, it is not correct to say, as my colleague has, that VA has not made a determination as to the best interests. So because of that determination.
That's hard to impossible to see from what was said, though. There's the caregiver got a notice that says virtually nothing.
The caregiver did receive a notice that indicated that it was found that there were several findings that it was determined that Mr. Nelson did not have a need for the personal care services over the last 6 months based on the activities of daily living or supervision, protection or instruction. Also that it was not in the best interest.
Statute doesn't say the last 6 months, just says over 6 months.
So it is, I will clarify, over 6 months. That is what the decision indicated, Your Honor. So I'm going with that. That is what the record shows. That is what the decision was. They made the decision. It was based on a clinical assessment of Mr. Nelson, as well as as my colleague has indicated, the initial interview process. And at that stage, there was enough information to deny the application, again, to include based on a determination of the best interest. And if I could, just to clarify the process, the Secretary's process is the two initial evaluations, interviews, the functional assessment, which is a clinical determination to determine the actual needs of the veteran. At that stage, there is the initial assessment, which again could be the dispositive assessment, the ultimate assessment, to see if the application should proceed further, if the adjudication should proceed further. If it's determined that it should proceed further, then VA will provide the required training to the family member, as well as conduct the home care assessment. Now, I also want to, again, clarify, so just to follow up on that, then there will be a final application review, and then if the application is denied, the applicants can either appeal, ultimately may bring us to the case today, or they can reapply for the program. And the record shows that Mrs. Nelson was aware of the ability to reapply. That is that I think that kind of goes to your question, Judge Jaquith, about was there any communications? This was in January. That was at page I think 1126 to 27 of the record, where she was she acknowledged that she could reapply. And when you reapply, the process starts all over again, and it's fairly rapid. Again, the regulations provide for like require and provide for a 90-day adjudication of the matter. So that could have occurred.
So how does this happen in practice? I jotted down 9 steps, maybe, or they can be compressed or enlarged. It's hard to tell. So there's a joint application kicks it off, and then there's the veterans eligibility evaluation under 71.20, a caregiver assessment under 71.25 BNC. I mean, those could technically happen at the same time, right? The team could interview both at the same
time.
Yes,
Your Honor.
Right?
And they do. That is part of the process. So okay. There's then, the veteran caregiver assessments, interviews, a functional assessment based on, again, an interview of the veteran.
And an assessment of the education training needed and completion 71.25D. That also,
that can all be happening at that point, Your Honor.
They could do all that fact-finding at that point. So then you said they make a functional assessment and then a stipend assessment? Or
no, a functional assessment, again, that's determining the veteran's needs, the personal care needs, again, based on a clinical evaluation of the medical needs.
They don't automatically do the in-home assessment. You said the in-home assessment would happen after an approval, or?
It's after a preliminary determination, Your Honor, that the application should proceed. Because as occurred here, there can be dispositive determinations at the initial assessment that for various reasons, like very simple eligibility reasons, like age of the family member or something like that, or from the functional assessment, the clinical assessment of the veteran to determine whether there are the personal care needs according to the specific requirements for those. So, and that is what occurred here. It was denied at that stage. If it's not denied at that stage, VA determines that it should go forward, and then VA will provide the training and will conduct the in-home assessment. Now, the reason for that is partially because it doesn't make much sense to provide training and to do the home assessment if you've already determined that the application is going to go no farther.
Practically speaking, though, if you did the two assessments, there's an interview or at least some communication. If that happened in the home, right? They could do at least a theoretical assessment of the home to see its suitability.
So
there's no reason that sequence has to happen after a kind of threshold eligibility determination.
I agree with you to the extent, Your Honor, that VA could have conducted the in-home assessment together with everything. It could do everything together before it makes any assessments or any determinations. But again, the Secretary's position or the why it's structured this way is because, and it wouldn't make sense to do those things, to conduct the training, provide the home assessment.
Your position is a lot more coherent if I think all the fact-finding can be done quickly and it doesn't take 5 years of, interlocutory appeals of the initial eligibility determination that takes a year to get back. And the idea that people can actually generate enough of a factual record that it would be capable of, especially for people at end of life stage, where they're not going to wait 5 years for a board hearing or something, where they can at least the factual record can be so developed that the board could in fact make an eligibility determination and just make all the necessary determinations that it would need to make.
Well, Your Honor, so yes, it could be done that way. That is not how VA does it right now. That's not how they've designed it.
Right, but otherwise, it's like a stairway into a wall to say, yes, theoretically, you could complete all these procedures and we could award veterans deceased people. It just will never practically happen because you'd have to deny, do it effectively something like an interlocutory appeal, have the eligibility or some predicate to try, and then the process kind of restarts.
Well, I think the logic, our position, Your Honor, is that, and what occurred here is that there was enough factual development analysis at the initial assessment phase based on the veteran and the caregiver assessments and that functional assessment to make the determination at that point, at the initial phase, the initial stage, which is what happened. So there was enough information at that point. There's no need to go into, again, to training the caregiver or to conducting the in-home visit, because that would, it's no longer necessary at that point. Now, again, I reiterate that.
Are you arguing now that the January 14th, 2001 determination was a medical determination, so eligibility doesn't matter, at least post January of 2001? And does that leave eligibility for care from the date of application to the date of denial?
Can you repeat the last question, part of the question, Your Honor? So if I may answer, the first part is that whether it is a medical determination, so it part of the overall determination is our medical determinations. I think that's consistent with Baudet, that while not everything is part of the program adjudication is a medical determination, there are. I think that we would generally equate that to what the regulations refer to as clinical determinations, or as part of the process, the functional assessment is a clinical evaluation. So it was the denial, and I think there was a December and then there was a January letter or notice as well. But that denial was an overall denial. It was an overall determination on the program that included the clinical determinations that was the functional assessment. So I know that answers the first part of your question. So if I may kind of circle back to the role of circle back to the process. So
the case, to try to clarify it maybe, but the case has been presented as if the January, I think that there was a phone call January 13th followed up with a letter January 14th that made the eligibility determination. The December stuff were two assessment calls.
Yes, Your Honor.
December 10th and December 29th. But the case has been presented as the January 13th, January 14th was a program eligibility determination. And that's what gave rise to the question about how does that eligibility process continue postmortem?
Right. So this is where I think it is important to recognize that it is not it is an overall determination. There is one determination that can be based on an eligibility determination. And again, to be clear, the eligibility determination does include a best interest determination per our regulation. So per 7120A, I'm excluding the first two, which are very basic eligibility. But the veteran is eligible if it is in need of personal care services, it is in the best interest to participate in the program. The personal care services will not be provided through another provider and other requirements. So that is built into the eligibility determination. So the eligibility determination, it can be characterized as that, and that's correct. But if that is the determination at that initial stage, then the eligibility determination is the final determination, but it already incorporates the best interest determination. So it is a final determination. It just happens to have been made at the eligibility stage. But because eligibility incorporates the best interest and all the required kind of determinations that Congress has required the Secretary make and consider, it is a complete determination. It is not just, as my colleague characterized it, there's separate eligibility and that's all that needs to be determined, and everything else past that is superfluous in some way. that it's not necessary. But that's not the way that the process works. It is one decision. It can happen at the eligibility or the initial stage, because eligibility can be based on, or does consider, the best interest and other factors other than some kind of basic factors of does the veteran service qualify, those kind of things.
It sounds like an effort to blur the process to get around Beaudet.
I disagree, Your Honor. I think VA has designed it as a deliberative process that takes into account that there can be determinations made at an earlier phase based on the evidence and all the information obtained at that point, and that if there needs to be more information gathered, in this case, that's a specific reference to the in-home evaluation, then it will proceed to that. That will occur, and that will then inform the overall decision. So I don't think that there's anything in there. And again, I take exception to the characterization of some of these things as checkboxes, especially with respect to the in-home care assessment. The purpose of that is to ensure that regardless of whether, or in addition to a determination that the veteran has needs, the required needs, and a determination that the family member is competent to provide those needs, there's still the kind of putting that together in, and I will quote the statute, which is section A5, big A, Romanet 2, which is to determine whether such requirements could be significantly or substantially satisfied through the provision of personal care services from a family member. So there is an overall determination, kind of wrapping everything together, of given these circumstances, is it still in the best interest of the veteran to receive this care from the family member in the home environment? And so the home care assessment is a critical component to making that determination, if you get to that point, because again, there can be other bases for denying the application and determining that the veteran or the caregiver are not eligible. But if you get past that, the threshold, not of just determining that they're eligible, it's not a you don't get a determination that you are eligible. Now we are going to this determine to make the final determination. If they get past that first stage, it's just, well, we're getting past the first stage, and we are now going to proceed with the additional necessary development and then make a determination from that at that point. At that point, the determination could still be that you are not eligible based on the information that VA has gathered from the in-home visit.
Where does this leave the Secretary's amended briefing concession that the board aired?
Well, our primary argument, Your Honor, is that the board's errors are not prejudicial here because even though it did not address these matters, that because of the circumstances here where Mr. Nelson, it was determined based on the evidence developed at the time, I think properly, that he was not eligible. And that is, I don't believe my colleague has demonstrated how that in itself was erroneous and denied the application at that point, that because of Mr. Nelson's death.
That is a new argument presented today for the first time. The argument that was presented in the briefing was that the caregiver wasn't eligible because process deficiencies, the lack of training, and that sort of thing.
That was one argument, Your Honor, but we also argued that the application could not proceed because of there was no basis at this point or reason to conduct the in-home assessment because with the death of the veteran, there is no longer a veteran to, and the regulation requires that it is an in-home assessment to determine the well-being of the veteran, the family member, and the family member's competence to provide the care for the veteran. So without the veteran in that circumstance, it is impossible to actually make that assessment based on the home care visit. That is the secretary's position. That is why the secretary has made the home visit a requirement, because that is essential for determining the best interests of the veteran. So, and that is what we have argued, that because, in part, because the home visit, that part of the process cannot be completed at this point, that that again, there's it will not be approved at this point.
Has VA ever approved eligibility in a case where there was not an in-home assessment conducted?
I do not have the answer to that question, Your Honor. I will be happy to get back to the court.
Has VA ever granted eligibility in a case where the caregiver did not receive the training?
I'm not sure of that, Your Honor, either.
So I want to follow up on the point I think that Judge Jakewith was making, and he can correct me if I'm wrong. So Secretary concedes at the amended brief at 12 that the applicant could, in theory, establish eligibility at the board, notwithstanding the veteran's death during the processing, right? So that's one concession. But then the secretary turns around and says that this court should affirm, because as a practical matter, the remaining steps cannot be completed, and then cites to two things involving the caregiver, one being the appellant's, in this case, ability to provide the required care, completion of the caregiver training, and a demonstration of her ability to provide care, and then the initial at-home assessment. So given the fact that the board here never got to the merits, how can the secretary ask this court to affirm when the board simply determined that as a matter of law, the appellant is ineligible here? But then you go on to say we should affirm for these reasons. How will we do that without fact-finding ourselves, without going into the record?
Because, Your Honor, that at this point there will be it does not require any fact-finding at this point, because as the process cannot be completed.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I mean, even things like what you told us about the steps, right? Is that part of any appellate record, right? We would, you know, because that seems to be kind of probative to your argument as to, well, there are these steps and they're necessary. I mean, we can look at the statute, but some of the color here seems to be more appropriate for remand than us.
And the fact of the matter is the January 14th, 2021 denial letter refers to three reasons for denying. They're all related to the veteran here, Mr. Nelson. The first is do not require care for family caregiver for a minimum of 6 months due to an inability to afford activity of daily living. Second one is participation in the caregiver program is not in clinical best interests. And the third one is do not receive care at home or will not do so if VA designates a family caregiver. And then it says, but you can appeal this decision.
Yes, Your Honor. So with regard to you noted at the beginning of your question that that all applied to the veteran. So I'm taking that as maybe an allusion to that. Well, there's the training requirement that has to do with the caregiver, the family member.
Have to meet both. Veteran or the service member has to meet eligibility criteria,
right.
And then the caregiver has to meet.
Right.
And
so
the secretary's position is that this court should affirm when the board never reached the merits, and the secretary has conceded that it was board error to deny based as a matter of law on the fact that the veteran is deceased.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, again, our position is that because of the requirements as part of the application process, the necessary requirements, again, they're necessary because they're critical to providing the information required to make the determination as to what is in the best interest of the veteran, that because those can't be completed, and I think clearly it is a requirement, the in-home care to assess the well-being of the veteran cannot be completed But even the training requirement, even if it had been that in itself is also dependent on the veteran and the veteran's circumstances. It is not all based on the caregiver. So to determine what is required, what training is required by the caregiver, requires a determination of what the needs are of the veteran.
Let me stop you there with the hypothetical. Let's say that the caregiver in this case is a registered nurse who specializes in palliative care. Would there be any need to go further with respect to the eligibility of the caregiver under those circumstances?
Under our regulations right now, Your Honor, we would still require the core training, which is something that can be done online. We probably at that point would not determine that there's a need for additional training. Again, I'm speculating, but that in itself is not definite. So without irrespective of the caregiver's professional or the family member's professional qualifications, whether or not it is in the best interest of the veteran to receive that care for the veteran's needs in the home environment is a different question. It is a broader question than just two things, whether the veteran needs care and whether the caregiver is competent. That does not answer the question. And something like the home visit is critical for determining that. There can be circumstances at the home which can demonstrate that even given a circumstance like that, Your Honor, that it is not in the best interest of the veteran to receive this care at home by the, maybe the registered nurse. There may be other reasons why that home environment is not conducive to that care. Or, again, there are infinite number of hypotheticals, examples, Your Honor, but that can be the case. It could be the cleanliness. It could be that the registered nurse does not keep a house that is clean, that presents dangers to the veteran. Again, there's an infinite number of hypotheticals or reasons why that could be the case, but the fact is it can be the case, and that is why the in-home visit is so essential.
So I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked opposing counsel, and that is there enough record evidence for the board here if we were to remand this case to make findings regarding eligibility both of the veteran and the caregiver in this case?
No, there is not.
Why not?
Because the death of Mr. Nelson precludes the necessary fact finding in the form of the home visit. And just to go back to...
But it wasn't Mr. Nelson's death that stopped the process. It was VA that stopped the process. And how can we accept that VA stopped the process and then says you can't show prejudice because you can't complete the process?
Because it is a required part of the process, Your Honor. It is necessary in order to provide the information to make the determination, the proper determination of whether it is in the best interest of the veteran to receive the care by the family member in the home environment. So that applies to obviously in cases where the veteran has not died. And I think that we can put this into a hypothetical where the veteran is still living. And then if it's possible to question the need for the in-home visit or frankly, any other specific requirement, clinical evaluations, let's say, that the secretary conducts, then it's just a situation where now the secretary is going to be questioned as to whether anything is ever required. So, and I think my point here is that the circumstances here or the requirements are no different whether the veteran is living or whether the veteran has passed away. The VA needs to conduct and has required the home visit and other requirements, the initial clinical evaluation, in order to proceed.
It wasn't going to do any of those things. It stopped the process by denying eligibility. It wasn't like there were there was a home visit planned or further inquiry was planned.
It did stop. Yes, it stopped.
Isn't that right in the mainstream of the Simmons test for prejudice? Prejudice is established by demonstrating an error prevented the claimant from effectively participating in the adjudicative process or affected or could have affected the outcome?
I think the difference here, Your Honor, where that doesn't apply is that the veteran can no longer participate in the process, just as a kind of a matter of fact at this point. And that participation itself is essential to in the circumstances where, like hypothetically here, on a remand, that we get past the initial evaluation and get to where there would be the need for the in-home assessment, that wouldn't be possible. And so there wouldn't be the required information in order to make that necessary determination of whether it is in the best interest of the veteran at that point. So it is something that, because of the kind of the unique nature of this program and this process, that is the result.
Am I right in reading the regulations that they don't necessarily contain a kind of internal sequence? I mean, obviously the process kicks off with the joint application, and then there's some markers where things have to happen before other things happen. But there's no, in the regulations, not like, okay, this happens first, then this happens second, and so down the line.
Yes, generally, Your Honor. So in in 7125, which is the approval designation section, so A2 Romanet 2, that kind of puts everything together as the bottom line is that all the evaluations must occur to include the participation in the home assessment. So again, that's the indication that kind of goes back to, and I know my time has expired, Your Honor. My initial attempt to clarify what the process is, that it is one decision. That's where the one decision comes from. Now, and then in E, that's where the home assessment, that's the home assessment provision. So the sequencing is mostly a result of logic, that if you can determine it based on the evaluations of record already, but then you're not going to proceed to that.
Yeah, no, it's a big deal, though, because we've kept you over time, and we're not going to let you go yet. But because, you know, I asked the question about the entitlement before, and, you know, one argument I think that the Secretary could have made is, listen, this is an entitlement, and so really the eligibility is conditioned upon being alive, right? I mean, how could it be in your best interest? But you didn't make that argument. I'm not saying you waived it, but obviously it wasn't your litigation position. Your litigation position was these types of assessments of eligibility are possible for a deceased person. They can go forward as long as the evidentiary record is in such a state, right? So fair enough. The question then going forward, if we said, okay, it's now normative reading of the statute that the, you know, eligible people, you can be deemed eligible after you're deceased, and then you can joint claim making, can you get payments from the date of the application, is that the processes themselves would kind of take place within the 90 days to allow for the type of complete evidentiary record that would allow for the type of board review to take place when the person's deceased. Right? Do you understand what I'm saying? To say like, okay, well, you get to step two and then you get this adverse determination, and then the whole train stops there. And because the board would never be able to consider a full evidentiary record, effectively, practically, there's really no relief, right? But these are two different things. That's why as a normative sequence, can these steps be done so that at least the compilation of a kind of an evidentiary record can be completed?
So, yes, the answer is yes, they could be. But again, the Secretary has determined that perhaps not in the regulation, but as a practical matter, policy for practicality's sake, of the sequencing there, that that is the most logical. You know, most
no, I get it. My question is, there's nothing like right now. I mean, the upon successful completion by a family member of a training is in statute. So you're required to have that procedure. The joint application is in statute. You're required. But your regulations haven't necessarily pinned you down to like a specific sequence. They're interpretations of the statute, and they could, there's some give in the joints there in terms of how it could be sequenced. I want to ask you about Baudet. So Baudet, you know, the Federal Circuit kind of resisted a sort of winner take all idea of either everything's jurisdictional or nothing, you know, everything's reviewable or nothing is, right? And it said, no, you know, the board, you know, basically makes findings as it do its own jurisdiction. Some things will be deemed medical determinations. They could presumably invoke their, just say that's, you know, that's medical. We're not going to rule on that. Other things are classic eligibility determinations. You know, they're really adjudicatory in nature where you're just looking at facts and you're applying to them to some legal standard element, something. What governing principle do you think the board will have to kind of operate in terms of looking at these cases with, you know, you've got lots of medical evidence nested within other evidence. I mean, how does it sort of go about separating it out?
So, of course, that is not what we relied on in our argument, right, Your Honor, as you know. But to answer your question, I believe that Baudet clearly acknowledged that there is a Federal Circuit, that there are some medical determinations and some that are not medical determinations, that, you know, generally a clinical assessment that the secretary provides should be considered a medical determination, and that would inform the board under in its review and in the court's review should that become necessary. Now I've described what the secretary considers to be clinical determinations, and that's both the initial functional assessment as well as the in-home assessment. So that is how we believe that that's what should inform the board, as to kind of a structure, an approach.
So
we are not relying.
It has to make an overall yes/no eligibility assessment, right? It would have to make predicate assessments if they find they decline eligibility based, say, on like the veteran's not eligible, right? Or the caregiver, right? There's going to be some assessment of facts as to the suitability of the caregiver if that's the reason for the denial. If there's alternate treatment options that are superior, right, someone would have to put facts in, and that would be a finding. Maybe that would be.
I think that there would be room for the board to, as there are in other contexts, to not provide its own clinical assessment, but to evaluate, see if there's some reason why that wasn't sufficient, you know, within the board's competence. But overall, if things that are, again, affecting, by definition, affecting the provision of medical care, those are medical determinations or clinical assessments. And so things that are clearly of that nature, I think that is what should inform the board through Baudet and how it should approach that.
Judge Lauer, do you have any further questions?
No, thank you.
Judge Jacobs.
Since there was nothing of that in the board decision in this case, the clinical assessment argument, don't we have to send the case back to them for that reason alone?
Again, Your Honor, no, we don't believe so, because, you know, we are not relying on that argument, on that issue. Our argument is that because of the required process that cannot be completed, that a remand would serve no useful purpose, because it would go back, it would not be completed, and then it would be denied again.
Is the evidence in the record as to what that process is, or would we be looking at the regulations and saying, oh, this seems to be there?
I don't recall from the record whether that process is outlined. Certainly the functional assessment is labeled as a functional assessment. And again, that was the basis of the denial.
The idea that an in-home assessment was never done, is that just you telling us? How do we know that? as part of the evidence of record, other than the parties informing. We don't doubt it, but we're limited to the evidence of an appellate record.
Well, I have the benefit of, collaborating and consulting our Veterans Health Administration officials in preparation for this and in our analysis. That's also publicly available information on the caregiver program about the steps that it does go through, as well as the eligibility requirements. So VA does lay that out in a public manner to the people that are applying or interested in applying for that program. So that is where that information is available. But as you said, Your Honor, the steps aren't outlined just like that in the regulation.
And anything else?
If I may, Your Honor, just to respond on the COVID matter.
1 minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. That was very specific to a national emergency. The exception in the regulation was that VA could use alternative means to conduct an in-home assessment. But one main point is that still presumes that the veteran is living, which is not the case here. There's still some assessment that tries to gather that information. And again, it still was a discretionary matter for VA. It wasn't required of VA, as I believe my colleague suggested. So, and in the final Federal Register entry that's cited in my colleague's brief, describes why the home assessment is so important. So that is, I believe, worth reviewing. And for the foregoing reasons, we ask the court to either affirm or modify as appropriate the board decision. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, let me start by returning to Your Honor's question about entitlement. And I think there may be additional context that might be useful to keep in mind. The stipend is, of course, the thing that's at issue here, because we're talking about what is available retrospectively. But when there are also things like respite care and counseling, and I think that the statutory provision there can also be read to explain that if, for example, and it is in fact true sometimes that there's not available respite care at a particular time when a caregiver wants it, that would be convenient for whatever else they need to do in their life, you don't have an entitlement to say, well, I demand my respite care next week or something like that. And so talking about the whole provision of benefits that's both within this program and the general caregiver support program, we're not just talking about a stipend. We're talking about other things as well that are not at issue in this appeal. Turning also to the question of the best interest determination and what has and hasn't happened in this case, turning to the January 14th, 2021 note, which is on page 1126 of the RBA, there is a statement that there has been a best interest determination insofar as it says your participation in PCAFC is not in your clinical best interest, your being the veteran there. But as my friend stated, the decision and the reason why there are additional steps in the home visit is to make a best interest determination. So it has not done, the VA has not done a complete record gathering process. It has stopped the process after that functional assessment instrument that occurred in December. And so Your Honor was asking whether this sort of serial nature is in the record. It's reflected in the record insofar as you can see that there was first an application, then a veteran assessment that occurred on the 10th of December. That is both an interview with Mr. Nelson as well as a discussion with the caregiver. After that, there is on the 29th of December, that's the veteran functional assessment instrument. So they're doing this serially. We first talk to the veteran and caregiver. There's some discussion about the well-being of the veteran and the caregiver in that first phone call, that veteran assessment. And then there is also the a very robust discussion of the needs of the veteran and what Mrs. Nelson did for her husband on a daily basis in that functional assessment. And then there's nothing else, right? There's nothing else happens between then and the denial. There's no offer for training. There's no home visit. Those things did not occur. So that, to the extent you're asking what is in the record that shows the serial nature of how VA has gone through this process, that's where your honors can look. Of course, the decision itself in January is quite sparse. It is only talking about the veterans' care. It doesn't explain the basis for that decision. It doesn't go through the steps. That's in part because this is, again, a decision from pre-Baudet, that there was not a presumption that anyone would be looking over VA's shoulder here. Certainly newer decisions actually go through each thing and said met, not met, or not evaluated. And most of the time when we're talking about a denial of eligibility, we're talking about veteran eligibility determinations, and they do cut off the process and say, we're not even going to evaluate the rest of the process. And that is a decision of the secretary. That's a problem of the secretary's own making. And certainly Mrs. Nelson should not be held responsible for VA's determinations about the best way to proceed in evaluating these cases. Unless your honors have any further questions, again, Mrs. Nelson respectfully requests that this court reverse the dismissal and remand for the board to make a determination in the first instance on the merits of her eligibility as well as Mr. Nelson's eligibility.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both of you. This case will be taken under advisement.
All rise.